We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
From Illinois Public Media, this is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Today we're going to take a look at happiness. Our guest is writer Gretchen Rubin. She spent a year reading works of philosophers and the findings of scientists and putting their knowledge to work in her life. She wanted to know, could she be happier? Well, she could, and it led her to write her new book, a bestseller titled The Happiness Project, or Why I Spent a Year Trying to Sing in the Morning, Clean My Closets, Fight Right, Read Aristotle, and Generally Have More Fun. The idea for The Happiness Project came to Rubin one day as she was riding the bus in New York City. She felt out of sorts about herself. She had a good life, but was concerned she wasn't living life fully. Later, she explained it to her husband like this: I am happy, but not as happy as I should be. I have such a good life. I want to appreciate it more and live up to it better. I complain too much. I get annoyed more than I should. I should be more grateful. I think if I felt happier, I'd behave better. That from Gretchen Rubin's book, The Happiness Project. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion this afternoon with your thoughts. I look forward to your questions and comments. Join us with a phone call or by email. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. The email address is will-talk@illinois.edu, will-talk@illinois.edu. Gretchen Rubin started out as a lawyer. She clerked for U.S. Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. Her previous books include 40 Ways to Look at Winston Churchill and 40 Ways to Look at JFK. Gretchen Rubin's book, her fifth, The Happiness Project, is published by Harper, and you'll find our guest's blog online at happiness-project.com. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and will-talk@illinois.edu. Gretchen Rubin, good afternoon. How are you?
I'm very happy to be talking to you.
And I'm happy to be talking with you as well. I love this book.
Oh, well, I'm so glad to hear that.
Well, when you began your happiness project, when you first explained it to your husband and friends, you were greeted with some skepticism, but now here it's a bestseller. So why are we kind of uncomfortable talking about making ourselves happy, yet we so much desire to be happy?
Well, that is one of the excellent question, and I was often puzzled by sort of how much people resisted the idea that a person would want to be happy. I think one assumption that people make is that people sort of find happy people annoying, and that they are, you know, their chirpiness or whatever kind of puts people off, which in fact is not true. Studies show that we're actually attracted to happy people. Or also an idea that being happy is selfish, and that you must be very self-centered and uninterested in the world if you are concerned about your own happiness. But in fact, I think certainly experience shows and also studies show that happier people are actually more interested in social problems and the problems of other people. So we have these assumptions about happiness, which actually turn out not to be true when you look at them more closely.
Hmm. Well, you have to be happy or you have to be at ease with yourself in order to go out into the world and work and do a good job at it.
Certainly, it's very true that happy people, they work better, they engage with others better, they have healthier habits. It really does. Taking the time and making the effort to think about yourself and what you need to do to have a happier life ends up making quite a difference in exactly how you're operating in the world.
Yeah. Now, at the outset, though, you too had some doubts, and you wondered if the Happiness Project was, in your words, supremely self-centered. How did you work through that?
Well, you know, part of it's from the excerpt that you read, I really did have this sense that I would behave better if I were happier. And that is, in fact, proved to be very true. And that when I'm happier, I'm more able to be patient, and I'm more able not to take offense, and I'm more able to worry about other people, and I'm more able to be lighthearted and laugh things off and not nag and not yell at my kids. And so really I realized that it wasn't self-centered or it wasn't selfish to think about being happier, because really I was so much more virtuous when I was happier. It just makes everything easier.
Yeah. Well, another thing you say early in the book is that you didn't want to wait for a crisis to remake your life. And this is when I really started liking this book. I think that's very wise. Would you talk about that?
Well, one of the resolutions that I kept as part of my Happiness Project was to read memoirs of catastrophe. So I read a lot of memoirs of people who had, had cancer or had terrible accidents or divorces or, whatever was a catastrophe in their life. And one thing that happened over and over again is this was really a catalyst for self-reflection and for change, and then also to think back on their life before and to think, oh, how happy I was then, if only I'd realized that I didn't appreciate it. And I realized a lot of times we use these big crises as catalysts, but I didn't want to wait for a catalyst like that because I wanted to see if I could change my life without changing my life and without waiting for something like that to sort of shock me into action, because I think those can be really good times to regroup and think about your life, but also ordinary life is just as good a time to think about what you want your life to look like.
Yeah. Well, one of the first things you did was to head out to the library.
Yes.
And then in September of your Happiness Project, your mission was to pursue your passion for books. What did you tell us about your passion for reading and writing?
Well, one of the things that I really recognized about myself was that this really was the central passion of my life. And sometimes I think we wish that I certainly wish that I were broader and that I had wider interests. But I really realized, this is my thing. This is my big passion. And it was funny because when I was writing the book, some people said to me, well, other people don't feel about reading the way you do. You really should talk about something broader that more people can identify with. And at first I thought, well, that's true. That's a good point. But then I thought, no, actually not, because this is my passion. This is what I want to talk about and how I tried to bring this passion more into my life. And I think people can identify with that desire. And then if it's not reading for them, it's cooking or it's mountain biking or it's camping or it's learning Italian or whatever it might be, and they can just sort of identify with the goal that I had and the ways that I went about doing it, even though the form of it would be different for them. But it really made me realize that if you're not paying close attention, it's very easy for the things that you love the most to get shoved all the way down to the bottom of your to-do list, where you never get around to them. And then I made myself so much happier by really saying, this is reading and writing, making books, reading, reading in bed is so important to me. I really have to make sure that I put that in my calendar like a dentist's appointment. I can't shove it to the side. And my life is so much happier now that I really, because you think, oh, if it's something that you love, of course, how could you ever not make time for it? But when I talk to people, I realize a lot of times people don't make time. They sort of feel like that should be spontaneous and easy. But everybody's so busy, you really have to make time for the things you love.
Yeah. Also, maybe we feel a little selfish when we make
time.
Yes. For for that kind of thing.
But one of the things, too, about having fun or pursuing your passion is that it really recharges you. And if you just go through your days feeling like there's nothing that you look forward to, there's nothing that's fun for you, it's really draining and overwhelming. And just having those little patches of something that you really look forward to or something that you just love can make all the difference in your experience of your day.
Yeah. You say that on your blog you found that some people feel overwhelmed by that question, what is your passion?
Yes.
Why?
Well, I think that word passion, it can make people feel like, oh, I don't have a passion, so there's got to be something wrong for me, or I don't know what it is. And so sometimes it's just, if you feel like that term is making you flinch, just sort of say, like, well, what is it that I like to do? How do I like to spend my time, and how do I bring more of it? A friend of mine was just saying to me how she loves doing crossword puzzles, but she always felt like that was sort of a waste of time. Like, she shouldn't be spending her time doing crossword puzzles. But then she realized, like, actually, she really loves doing crossword puzzles, and instead of trying to shove it aside and pretend like it's not legitimate, she should say, oh, I'm going to make time for crossword puzzles, and I'm going to really try to get better, and I'm going to challenge myself by doing harder ones, and really bring it into her life in a way, embrace it. Now, would she say that it's a passion? Maybe it doesn't rise to the level of, it doesn't sort of sound like a passion, which seems like it should be some huge thing. But it's certainly something that she loves and that she wants to spend time on. So, yeah, don't get hung up on the word passion if it's not working for you.
Yeah. I'm sure you've seen the movie Julie and Julia.
I read the book. I did not see the movie.
Oh, okay. I haven't read the book, but I've seen the movie. And there's a wonderful scene between Meryl Streep and Stanley Tucci, Meryl Streep playing Julia Child and Stanley Tucci playing her husband, Paul Child. There's a wonderful scene where they're eating in a restaurant together, and they are setting up their lives in Paris after the war. And Julia is saying, what am I going to do with myself? And he says to her, what is it that you like to do? What do you love to do? And she goes, eat!
Exactly.
And then, you know, that's the moment that propels the film onward. So...
Well, I just by chance read the book My Life in France, which is the book which I think was also a big source for the movie, which I did not see. But yes, I mean it's an exhilarating happiness project to read about Julia Child, and she really had no idea. I mean, here she was; she was a grown up, and she was in France because her husband got transferred there. So everything about it was just sort of something that was happened accidentally, essentially. And here she finds this gigantic passion, and she so embraces it. And you read about her incredible diligence and the discipline that she brought to it, and the endless curiosity and the endless enthusiasm. It's so exciting. It's just, I don't even care about food. Actually, somebody on my blog told me that they thought I needed to see a doctor because it wasn't normal to, like, not care about food the way I don't care about food. I really don't care about food, but I don't care because Julia Child just makes you so happy with her enthusiasm and just this idea that she came on it. Like, you never know if you're open to it, but she sort of had to have that recognition. What do I love to do? I love to eat. And what does that mean? How do I follow up on that? I mean, it's a great example of, you know, sometimes the answer maybe isn't what you think it's going to be, but you just have to be open to what it is that you really love.
Hmm. What led you to the law and then away from the law into writing?
Well, I went to law school for the same reason that a lot of people go to law school, which is basically I couldn't think of anything other. You know, I was really good at reading and writing and analysis, and my father was a very, very happy lawyer, and it seemed like a good idea. It'll keep my options open. So all the things that I now counsel people, be very careful before you go to law school because those aren't good reasons. So I went and I had a great time. I loved law school, and I had a great experience as a lawyer. But I just finally realized that I really wanted to be a writer, and there was all kinds of clues from my past that I wanted to be a writer, but I was not really paying attention to them. But then at some point, finally, I realized, and I was actually working on a book at the time in my free time, which should have been a pretty major clue that I wanted to be a writer. And then finally I had the realization that what I was doing for a hobby, essentially, was what some people did as their job. And I really wanted to have my work be what it was that I was doing for fun. And so I decided to make the switch about 10 years ago.
Sounds like it's worked out well.
It has. Well, I was very lucky because I think a lot of people who leave law don't know what they want to do. They know that they don't really want to be practicing law the way they are, but they're not sure what they would do instead. And in a way, I was very fortunate because for me, the desire to write became so irresistible. It was so painful not to be doing it that it made it very easy for me to make, you know, a very, very risky choice. Mm. You know, in retrospect, I'm surprised I wasn't more daunted by it than I was.
This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is writer Gretchen Rubin. She's the author now of 5 books. The latest is The Happiness Project, or Why I Spent a Year Trying to Sing in the Morning, Clean My Closets, Fight Right, Read Aristotle, and Generally Have More Fun. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, share your thoughts about happiness. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. You may also join us by email. Our email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. What were among the most useful books for your happiness project?
Well, the first, the one that I copied the most was Benjamin Franklin's autobiography. Benjamin Franklin is a great patron saint of all people trying to do happiness projects because he was very much that way himself. And he had this chart that he made of his 13 virtues that he had 13 virtues that he was trying to cultivate, and he would check them off every day about whether he'd observed them or not. And so I use that as something that I called my resolutions chart, which is a chart that I make of all my resolutions that I check off every night. And so that was very influential because it gave me that idea, which ended up being extremely important for my happiness project. A book that I did not expect to be so influenced by was a book called Story of a Soul by St. Thérèse of Lisieux, who is a Catholic saint who lived more than 100 years ago, who died at the age of 24 from tuberculosis. And she wrote this memoir, which had this enormous impact on me. And I really sort of became a sort of obsessive student of St. Thérèse. Because her whole thinking is about this idea of the ordinary day and what would you do in your ordinary day, not doing like sort of great deeds or big splashy things, but what would you do in your ordinary day? So that was very attractive to me. And then the book that or the writing of most influential to me probably is Samuel Johnson, who wrote essays, moral essays, and also was the subject of The Life of Samuel Johnson by John Boswell, which is one of the most famous biographies. And Johnson was just this incredible observer of human nature and a fantastic writer. And so often I would be reading what he would write, and I would think, oh, my gosh, that's me. That's describing me, or now I understand the world better. So those three were really the most influential for me as I was doing my happiness project.
Yeah. And what kind of science did you read about the science of happiness? What did you learn there?
It's an incredible explosion of research in this area, which is great, coming out of the positive psychology movement that started about 10 or 15 years ago, and also economics. There's a lot of economic study of it now, too. So there's a huge amount of research. I still read it all the time. It's changing a lot. You really have to stay on top of it to know kind of what the current thinking is. But it's really fascinating to see. But I was kind of surprised that, you know, in the end, Samuel Johnson really taught me more about human nature than even, you know, the biggest scientific, you know, most heavily footnoted scientific paper. So I think the science is very, very useful and really helpful. But in the end, sometimes I felt like I got more insight into the truth from these other kinds of students of happiness.
Yeah, and also you read some novels that were useful to you as well.
Yes. Novels were, you know, one of the things I loved about the Happiness Project, it was just basically a license to read everything that I felt like reading. It's like, oh, this is about happiness. But there's amazing novels about a book like Happy All the Time by Laurie Colwin, or the books of Marilynne Robinson. Tolstoy writes a lot about happiness. There are amazing novels that really gave a lot of insight into happiness.
Yeah. You have 12 commandments.
Yes.
You want to tell us about a couple of those. One of them, though, is act the way you want to feel. And this is Act Happy Week.
Oh.
So there we have something to tie in here with the 12 commandments. Talk about a couple of them and then, of course, include act the way you want to feel.
Well, act the way you want to feel is really interesting. This is something that ended up being incredibly powerful. This idea is very well established in psychology. I think William James was writing about it 100 years ago. And that's the idea that although we sometimes assume that we act because of the way that we feel, we actually often feel because of the way that we act. So if you're stomping around the room, slamming doors, and yelling, you're telling yourself, I am angry, and you fan those feelings of anger in yourself. Whereas if you act calm and lighthearted, you will tell yourself, I feel calm and lighthearted. And it's really kind of uncanny the degree to which you can change your emotions by changing your behavior. And that's what William James said. You know, it's hard to change your thoughts and your emotions, but you can change your actions much more easily. And so if you don't like the way you feel, you can turn that around by acting the way you wish you felt. And it can be hard to do in the moment. But whenever I've done it, I'm constantly struck by how sort of weirdly effective it is. You really can change your emotions by just acting the way that you wish that you felt. So that's something that comes up constantly in my life, like with my children. If I'm feeling exasperated but I act cheerful, pretty soon I start to feel cheerful. It really works. But the most important personal commandment by far is be Gretchen. So, of course, everybody has to substitute their own name. But be Gretchen is just this idea that you can only build a happy life on the foundation of your own nature. So you always have to think about what's true for you. You can't think about what's true for other people or what other people think ought to make you happy or what you wish made you happy. You really have to take it down to yourself and say, you know, Julia Child loved food, but I don't love food, or you know, or whatever it is. You really have to look to yourself for those answers. And it seems like, well, what could be more obvious than to know yourself? But actually, this is, you know, one of the most ancient happiness precepts, and really one of the most challenging things to follow, but very important, because that's really the way that you build a happy life is just by knowing who you are and what makes you happy, what your values are, and then, you know, putting those into your ordinary day.
Yeah.
Another one is, this is be polite and be fair. This comes from, I had just gotten a big promotion, and the sort of upper boss, I sort of confided to her, and she was this very kind of stern person. I sort of said something like, well, I I'm not sure I can do it. I'm not sure that I can handle this job. And she looked at me fiercely and said, be polite and be fair, and you'll be fine. And I think in life, if you remember to be polite and be fair, that will take you through most situations. So I often remind myself that when like I'm in a complicated, you know, circumstance, and I'm just wondering how to conduct myself or how to, you know, negotiate through it. And I think, you know, as long as I'm polite and fair, I'm going to be fine. And I think that's just really very helpful to remember.
Yeah, and that's pretty easy to do.
You think it would be, but it's often a good corrective to say to yourself, am I being polite? Am I being fair?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's a good thing to remember.
You have another list you call Secrets of Adulthood, and one of them is if you're not failing, you're not trying hard enough.
Yes, one of my resolutions is to enjoy the fun of failure. Because this idea of failure, if you're a certain kind of person, and I think a lot of people fall into this camp, you don't want to fail. You really want to be succeeding. You want to be on the top of your game, and you don't really want to face failure. But what I realize is that if you're not failing, you're not trying hard enough. Anything worth doing is worth doing badly. And I really wanted to embrace failure as part of the process and really encourage myself to take risks and be willing to fail and have things not work out or, you know, not get things that I tried for, and just see that as a positive. And in fact, when I wrote about enjoy the fun of failure, somebody posted a comment to my blog saying, I don't think you should think about it as failure. You should reframe it and put it in this more positive light. And at first I thought that seemed very sensible, but then I thought, no, I'm not trying to pretend that I didn't fail. The whole point here is I wanted to say, that's fine. You failed, that's fine. You have to be failing in order to succeed. If you're not failing, you're not trying hard enough. And it's fun to fail and just embrace it. And that has really helped me be more of a risk taker and be more willing to go out on a limb and experiment with things. Because if you're willing to fail, you've got a lot of opportunities. So that's been a very helpful thing for me to keep in mind.
Yeah, that's why they have Band-Aids.
Yes.
Fall down.
Yep.
And this also fits right in nicely to the top secret of adulthood. People don't notice your mistakes as much as you think.
Yes, people just don't. They're not as focused on you as you think. And it's just good to remember, you know, not everybody's not paying attention to you. And you just don't have to be so caught up in the mistakes that you make or feeling self-conscious or feeling like everybody is paying so much attention to you, because really they're not. It's good to remember.
The first thing you set out to do was boost energy. It was January. Why did you begin there?
I started with energy because I figured if I had more energy, everything else that I was going to try would be easier. Like if I was going to try to quit nagging, or I was going to try to imitate a spiritual master, or any of those things. And I realized it was actually really was a very good place to start, because when you have energy, you just naturally feel happier. And it's also wherever, one thing that I've noticed is when I talk to people about happiness is, you know, your own body and your own physical circumstances really, you know, happiness can feel like this very transcendent, abstract thing, but your own body, your own physical circumstances will always be an influence on you, because that's where you are. You're in your body, in this place, in this office, in this house, in this car. And with energy, I saw it as both physical energy. So I worked on things like getting more sleep and exercising, which are both very incredibly important to happiness. And I'm now a sleep nut. And also then mental energy, which was things like clearing clutter and getting rid of nagging tasks, both of which are things which drain people's energy. And I have to say, as I've talked to people about happiness projects, the thing that has really consistently surprised me is the degree to which clearing clutter seems to energize people. Over and over and over, people say to me, you know, I cleaned out my closet and I got this huge boost. And it seems very disproportionate, because having a messy desk in the context of your life is not such a big deal, but somehow people seem to get a disproportionate charge of happiness when they tackle those things. So it was a really good place to start, because by just managing these externals ended up having a pretty big impact that helped get me started with maybe some things that were a little bit more challenging.
What is it about stuff that can so tie us up?
It is such a good question. It's funny. It's something that is not talked about in the positive psychology very much, and yet popular culture is obsessed with it, and I certainly see it all the time when I'm talking to people. I think part of it is, for many people, outer order contributes to inner calm. So getting rid of things that don't work, things that are in the wrong place, drawers that won't shut, you know, cars that won't fit in a garage, like things like that, really weigh on people. And then getting control of it really makes people feel so much more serene. And, you know, there's just so much stuff flooding in. In fact, one of my rules now is don't take anything for free. I mean, sometimes there are exceptions to that. But almost any time when somebody's like, hey, do you want this T-shirt? Do you want this coffee mug? You're like,
no.
You know, how many coffee mugs does one family of four need? you know, don't let it in your house, because then you're just going to have to do something with it. And so, yeah, just the stuff, it weighs people down. And I think the more people get on top of that, it really does have surprisingly large consequences.
This is The Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Our guest this afternoon, writer Gretchen Rubin. Her latest book is The Happiness Project. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a phone call or by email, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Let's take a call from a listener in Champaign waiting for us on line one. Hi.
Hi. I watch PBS a lot, and there was a series in January called This Emotional Life. And it was about, at the end, they talked about, okay, the secret to happiness. So at the end of the last program, they told us the secret to happiness. And their conclusion was it was people's relationships with other people. And spouses and friends, not so much kids. And so I decided to do my own little project, and I called and wrote a number of people to let them know how important they were in my life. And that was also a boost for me. The first person I called had just witnessed an altercation in her living room between her husband and her husband's child's mother. And she said, "You called at exactly the right time. You just made my day." So I was very excited to hear that you were talking about happiness today.
Great. Well, that's a fantastic idea. I know that the series that you're talking about, and the third, I don't know about all of them, but certainly the third one was moderated by Daniel Gilbert, who's very well known in the area of happiness. And this idea that strong relationships are a key to happiness is like, it's an ancient idea that's just being proven by science, but is absolutely true. And something like that, like not only are you reaching out and kind of strengthening existing relationships, but it's also a gratitude exercise, which is also incredibly important to happiness, which is to think
Absolutely.
About how, you know, what you have to be grateful for and letting people know that. So that is that's like a happy, wonderful happiness project. And it sounds like it did indeed make you happier, and also it made other people happier too, which is which is wonderful. I'm sure they would be thrilled to hear that their program did exactly what it was meant to do, which was to inspire people to take action in their own lives to become happier. So
cool.
That's a great story.
Okay.
Thank you very much for the call this afternoon. Let's take another call, a listener in Chicago. Line 4, hi.
Hi. I wanted to offer a couple comments on happiness, a couple thoughts I had. I've looked at happiness mainly from a religious perspective. I've been influenced by the writings of St. Francis de Sales. I don't know if you've read his works, but he did some spiritual writing, and he's pretty well known in religious circles. But I wanted to offer a couple thoughts in the sense that I found it difficult to find happiness in anything, you know, worldly things. For instance, you know, if the weather makes you happy, you know, from one day to the next, you're going to be disappointed. You know, if it's sunny one day, you'll be happy, and another day it's, raining, you'll be sad. I don't think you can find happiness in material things, or if you're into sports, some days you're going to win, some days you're going to lose. And I think lasting happiness can't be found in these types of things. And the other thought I was going to offer was we have an influence on the happiness of people around us. I found this over the years, time and time again. The way we interact with people affects their happiness, and I think we have to keep that in mind. And I've tried to, I don't say I'm perfect in that sense, but I try to deal with other people around me in as, you know, cheerful a way as possible and as gently a way as possible, because, you know, people are so fragile. And, you know, I think what we do really affects their happiness. And, you know, so I don't look at this from my own perspective, but from the people around me. And I try to make that a resolution, to just try to be as cheerful and as, you know, gentle with people, you know, especially your family. And because there's all kinds of problems coming up all the time. And so I just wanted to offer those two thoughts.
Okay, Gretchen?
Yeah, I mean, just to the second point, yes, the idea that it's actually a very well-known phenomenon that you're pointing out, which is something called emotional contagion, which is the idea that people catch emotions from each other. And they absolutely do catch emotions from each other. And happy people make people happy. And unfortunately, negative emotions are more catching than positive emotions. So it is really important to try to stay positive, because you can really bring people down if you have that. You know, one of the things that I was most excited about with my happiness project was this idea that I came to that I call the second splendid truth, which is the idea that one of the best ways to make yourself happy is to make other people happy, and one of the best ways to make other people happy is to be happy yourself. And I think you're talking about that, which is that by having that happiness, by having that cheerfulness, by sort of having the resolution that you're going to try to have that for other people, you will make them happier, because people really draw on the happiness of others. And so Robert Louis Stevenson said that we have a duty to be happy. And I think that the kind of thing that you're talking about is exactly what he meant.
Yeah. And you use Stevenson's comment as an epigraph at the start of your book. He said it's the most underrated duty we have.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Let's take another call. A listener calling in on a cell phone, line 4. Hi.
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 Well, I hate to spoil the party. I think you're completely and totally off base. I think you are simply exhibiting a national obsession, almost a neurotic obsession, of being happy all the time. That stupid yellow smiley face thing has exhibited it for quite some time, as far as I'm concerned. Now, maybe you're not quite. Maybe what you really mean is people should try to get some satisfaction out of life. Ask a person, are you satisfied with your life? But happiness, people aren't happy all the time. What makes you think happiness is some natural state of being? People are happy sometimes. They're really sad other times. And I doubt that any one of those conditions can exist in a person for very long at one time. How can you be happy if you don't experience the opposite at some time? So I really think you're off base on this. I mean, what people need to do is figure out a way to lead a satisfying life that they feel is maybe lives up to their understandings of the morals they've been brought up with and the standards of living that they brought up with. But there's a single-minded obsession with happiness. I mean, if we want to be happy, we could just all shoot heroin for the rest of our lives. We'd be happy, I'm sure, but I don't think that's really what humans are aiming for when they say they're not happy.
Okay, Gretchen Rubin, what do you think?
That's a perfect articulation of something that people raise to me all the time, which is A, there's no such thing as happiness. Happiness doesn't exist. Or that what do we know? What does it mean when we say we're happy? Like, it doesn't mean this. It means that. We shouldn't be talking about this. We should be talking about that. It's not. It's contentment or it's joy. It's fulfillment. It's satisfaction. And that happiness is unattainable or undesirable or fleeting. And what I would say to that, I mean, I think these are all good points. One of them is people get very hung up on this idea of happiness. What does the word happiness mean? So I think it's sometimes more helpful to think about happier. So it's not about achieving happiness like this magical destination that you get to and that everything's perfect forever, which I don't think is something that is realistic and really is not what people are talking about. But I think it's sometimes more helpful to say, can you be happier? Today, tomorrow, next month, are there things that you could do to be happier? Maybe you wouldn't be happier all the time, but are there ways that you could just change your life to be just that much happier? And a lot of times people who don't even admit to the existence of happiness will say like, yeah, well, kind of grudgingly, I could be happier. So you can think about being happier. And then on this idea of what is happiness, there's about 15 academic definitions of happiness, and in fact, the distinction that the caller pointed out is between positive affect and life satisfaction, which is something that is very, you know, the academics who study this really get into the very, very precise definitions. To my mind, I mean, I was a lawyer, so I spent a semester arguing about the definition of a contract. So I sort of decided I was just going to leave happiness out there as this idea, being happy. And it could kind of take on its shape from whatever a person wanted it to be. I think it looks different to different people, and it's not that important that we all agree. But again, it's just this idea of being happier according to whatever you think. I do think that I don't think that many people are arguing that everybody should be being happy 100% of the time, or that there's no benefits or that we want to be fighting the idea that you should never have any negative emotions, because certainly those are natural and often helpful. That's not the goal, the worthy goal, and certainly the idea that if everybody assumes that if they could shoot heroin all the time that they would be happier. I think few people would think that would be a recipe for a truly happy life. Mm. And I think that this idea that being virtuous is important. It is important because people are happy when their lives embody the values that they uphold, that, you know, they want to uphold their values, they want to live their values, and people are happier when they see their values enacted in their own life. And so, which sometimes, means that their life is less maybe filled with pleasure in the moment, but leads to happiness
over the long term. But certainly these are extremely important, very central questions to anyone doing a happiness project, which is, what is the nature of happiness and what does a happy life look like, and is it even a desirable or worthwhile goal to be seeking?
Yeah, and for you, going back to my introduction, which is something that I took from your book, is that you said at the outset of your happiness project, I complain too much. I get annoyed more than I should. I should be more grateful. I think if I felt happier, I'd behave better.
Yeah.
So that's different than shooting up with heroin, for sure.
Yes. Well, Oscar Wilde said something, and Oscar Wilde, you know, he's always thought-provoking and he's always witty, but he's not always 100% correct. But it's something worth thinking about. And let me see if I can get this right. He said, one is not always happy when one is good, but one is always good when one is happy. And I really do think that when people are happy, they find it easier to be good. They find it easier to be patient. They find it easier to be helpful. They find it easier to go out of their way. They find it easier to have healthful habits. Certainly, in my experience, I behave much better when I'm happier. So I think you know, and things like gratitude, like the earlier caller was talking about. You know, when you're grateful to other people, you have much less room to feel resentful or angry. And so all these things sort of build on each other.
Yeah. Well, our first two callers this afternoon really dovetailed nicely. They spoke about relationships, our relationships with one another and how important they are. And that was the task that you took up in February of your happiness project. You call it Remember Love. And this was really eye-opening to me. I suppose if you think about it for a minute, it makes perfect sense. But you write, it takes at least 5 positive marital actions to offset 1 critical or destructive action. So one way to strengthen a marriage is to make sure that the positive far outweighs the negative.
Yes, and I find that to be very, very true. And one kind of an interesting side note on the difference between men and women, which is something I didn't look at a lot in my happiness project, but is that men are much more disturbed by negative interaction, like fighting, than women. Like women, it doesn't bother as much, and men really, really upsets them, which I thought was interesting. So you really want to make sure that you keep the positive, you know, very, very active, and really try to minimize those negative moments, or try to find ways to make them like less negative. I mean, one of the things that always works the best, it's very, very hard to do, but if you can do it, is to just joke about things. Instead of railing about them or nagging about them or yelling about them, just sort of like make a joke of it. And you can get your point across and sort of relieve your thoughts in a way that's more lighthearted and more fun, and it just leaves a better taste in everybody's mouth.
We've got 2 listeners waiting to talk with us. Let's go ahead and see if we can get them both in now here. Line 1, listener in Champaign. Hi.
Hi. I was just wondering, you know, if your guest, happiness is a very hard and difficult topic, you know, it depends how one looks at it and so on. I was wondering if you have done any studies or your observations, I would more ask, of how happiness is measured in different other cultures, in other words, cross-cultural, your opinion on happiness measured, you know, by people or looked at, you know, by people of different countries in the world, particularly East, Middle East, you know, China, Japan, Korea, and so on. There are countries which are rated saying, well, number one, such and such, and number such and such in terms of people being happy. And also, like in India, if you'll see, they have, you know, like anything else, happiness clubs, more like a laughter club. People go early morning, like doing yoga and all those things. They all get together. And the first thing I think they do is try to open up, they laugh, they joke, they just, you know, like start a day with happiness. Quote-unquote, you know, I don't know if that lasts for the whole day or not. But your thoughts of the definition or how happiness is looked in other cultures of the world.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good question.
That is extensively studied. It's not something that I looked at very much because, you know, my whole lens of the Happiness Project was to look very specifically at my own experience, just as a way to limit the discussion, because otherwise it's just a gigantic topic. So I didn't really look at that, but if you're interested, there's a huge amount of research on that, and also sort of how people conceive of happiness, how they they conceive of life satisfaction and how their maybe, you know, the individualism or not of a culture might affect the kind of happiness that they would experience, what kind of conditions lead people to be less happy or more happy. So that's certainly something that has been is a hotbed of research. Many, many people are very interested in that. And, no, and I think that's great. I actually tried laughter yoga myself as one of my experiments, and it did not work for me because I was so self-conscious. I couldn't experience the fun of it and the laughter of it. But I know that many, like millions and millions of people practice laughter yoga all over the world. It started in India, and certainly anything that like anything that gets you relating to other people and laughing and joking around is great. I mean, I think that's fantastic. You know, we should all try. One of the things I did in my happiness project was to really focus on my morning and try to make my morning more positive, because I think the way you start your day is very important for your mm-hmm. day-long happiness outlook.
Let's take one more call here. We've got about a minute or two left. Champagne line two, hi.
Hi there, and I have a quick comment, and perhaps it's simplistic, but I'd like to know if your guest would agree that happiness truly is a choice. We can choose to start our days out with happiness and positive actions towards others, or we can choose to be critical, as some people are, and degrading and cutting down, and you wind up not only making your day bad, but you make that person's day bad, too, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay. Gretchen?
I think it's absolutely true that you can think about specific actions that you're going to take or not take, and that those are going to have a big effect on your happiness. And I think the challenge is to think about, well, what are the specific actions that you're going to do or not do that are going to make you have a happier day and a happier life and happier interactions with other people? So I think that's really a great place to start. It's just, how are you going to translate the life that you want into the actions that are going to get you there? So I think that's a very good point. Absolutely.
Gretchen Rubin, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
I was very happy to do it. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Gretchen Rubin is a writer. Her latest book, The Happiness Project, it's published by Harper. You'll find our guest's blog online at happiness-project.com.